Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author. Each week, Dr. Crosby interviews a fascinating new guest on a range of compelling topics, from literature to psychology to financial wellness. To learn more about Dr. Crosby's behavioral finance work at Orion, visit www.orion.com.
Hello and welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby, and I am joined today from across the Atlantic by Paul Craven. Paul is one of my favorite behavioral thinkers. He's someone whose speaking and whose videos, his TEDx talks, his Nudge Stock talks have been influential in my own thinking, and it's a real privilege to have him here today. Paul, thanks for joining us.
And thank you very much for having me.
So, Paul, this is a podcast, so we're gonna break the first rule of podcasting and talk about the visuals. But I'm looking behind you, and you have a stage, and you have sort of like two goddesses, lanterns. It's this beautiful setup. Tell us about your office.
It is my working office for about 362 days a year, but for four evenings a year, I should say, I have a stage to the side of the office. And it's got drapes and curtains and statues, as you say, and I have spotlights and things on the stage. And four times a year, I have some celebrated, well-known magicians, sometimes often from the States, but from the UK or Europe as well. And we have an evening of magic and mystery, which I invite about 24 guests. I make them dress up in black tie. I make them drink champagne. Not that they need much encouragement to do that. And we have an evening of fun, and it's a really classy Edwardian style parlor evening of magic, and it's great fun. And it's, of course, magic is my hinterland. It's what I do when I'm not thinking about investment or work or business.
So I have just invited myself to said party. I think I may be in England for Humans Under Management in November, and I am now twisting Paul's arm to have a party when I'm there, because it looks absolutely awesome.
Well, make sure you bring your tuxedo.
Oh yes, I will bring my tuxedo. So Paul, let's start with magic. You're a member of the Magic Circle, which is a British organization devoted to advancing and promoting magic. Now, the motto of the society, perhaps you can say it. No one from Alabama should ever speak Latin, but it's Indocilis Privata Loci or something like that, which roughly translated means not apt to disclose secrets, which made me giggle. I am not afraid to say, which made me laugh pretty hard. That's a pretty incredible motto. What can magic tell us about behavioral science and psychology, and how do you sort of marry these two worlds together?
That's a very good question. And sometimes in my mind, I do merge them together because they kind of join around the back of the circle. And let me explain why. Firstly, a little bit about the Magic Circle. It's a very prestigious magic society. It's been around since 1905. We've got about 1,500 members worldwide. And we have a current president, Megan Swan, she's doing a fantastic job. I'd encourage anybody who comes to London to come and visit the Magic Circle. They put on public shows as well as having private evenings for the members. And I was honored recently to be made an associate of the Inner Magic Circle with a silver star. It's kind of like concentric rings on an archery target. So I'm trying to move closer towards the center. But to your question, so why magic and behavioral science? I think the main reason is that for me, behavioral science, which is something I've been interested in for as long as I've been interested in magic, is about trying to understand how your mind and my mind plays tricks. And that concept permeates through all of the stuff I talk about on stage, my keynote talks, my workshops. And what does that mean? Well, it's about trying to uncover hidden biases, heuristics, and I like to think of them as mental shortcuts, especially in the interaction between the conscious and the unconscious mind. And so I think what I'm trying to do in behavioral science is to understand how the human mind works and where does it work and where doesn't it work very well. And to link back to your question, in a kind of way, magicians are doing that. They're exploiting the bits of your mind that don't work very well. And they're helping you use the bits that do work well to come up with what you think may be solutions, but then you find out later on, actually, they're not at all. And so I think there is a link. And our mutual friend Rory Sutherland has written a book, Alchemy, obviously taking the magic theme. And he talks about behavioral science being like alchemy in some ways. And I think that's a really interesting comment. I mean, lots have been written about this by psychologists who study the art of magic, for example, saying when and how people are fooled. But my preferred quotation comes from a magician called Jerry Andrus, the late Jerry Andrus, an American magician, who came up with this lovely line. He said, "I can fool you because you're human. You have a wonderful human mind that works no different from my human mind. Usually when we're fooled, the mind hasn't made a mistake. It's come to the wrong conclusion for the right reasons." Now, I think that's brilliant because for me, a lot of behavioral science is about coming to the wrong conclusion for the right reasons. And if we come on to talk about some of the things about behavioral science and where the controversies are at the moment, it's essentially, is our biases irrational? And I'll argue that they can be, but they're not always in terms of their origins and their derivations. They can be totally rational, but just applied in the wrong environment. So I love the link with magic. And on my talks on stage, I'll use optical illusions. There's obviously a very strong business focus in my talks, I should emphasize. I'm not necessarily a professional magician, but I'm a professional public speaker. But I like to use it. And one thing that's quite interesting, Daniel, is if you go up to an audience and you say something like, "Can I show you a magic trick?" That's not a good thing to do as a business speaker. However, go up to an audience of 3 or 4 hundred people and stand on stage and say, "I want to talk about your mind. Ladies and gentlemen, can we try a psychological experiment?" Everyone's interested. I've reframed it. And guess what? It's hopefully quite attractive, quite enchanting, sometimes endearing. And it helps me make lots of serious business points by doing a so-called psychological experiment. Well, what is a magic trick if it's not a psychological experiment?
Mm-hmm. No, it's interesting because former guest and mutual friend of ours, Jim O'Shaughnessy, was very big into magic for a time. And he's one of the greats when it comes to bridging sort of behavioral finance and quantitative investing. I think there's a strong interest in magic among the skeptical community. You know, you have people like Penn and Teller who are really big into skepticism and also, of course, are wonderful magicians. So is there... how do you see the world differently as a magician? I mean, does it make you more believing, less believing? Do you move through the world differently as someone who has studied sort of the art of how the mind fools us and how we fool each other?
I think what it's made me most aware of is the power of the unconscious mind. Because, and again, I can jump between behavioral science and between magic because... in either case, what I think I'm saying is the unconscious mind is extremely powerful. And I think what comes across increasingly, whether it be the academic work on the behavior side or the kind of stuff I'm doing in the magic world, it's you're trying to actually to often talk to the unconscious mind. That's really where, if you want to be an effective communicator, for example, and we kind of kid ourselves that we're all logical, rational, evidence-based, analytical individuals. And what we are sometimes, and we can be all those things. But too often, we tend to rely upon the unconscious mind, sort of system one type thinking of Daniel Kahneman. Jonathan Haidt's got a wonderful metaphor, which you probably know, the elephant and the rider. Mm-hmm. He says that the conscious mind is like the rider. You think you're making the decisions. The unconscious mind, the powerful, silent beast, the elephant, is the one really making the decisions. And if you or the rider want to go that way towards the what you think is an attractive strategy in your business world, but the elephant's thirsty and sees a water hole over there, guess where we're going to go? And so
right.
We're both trying to understand more about how the unconscious mind affects our decision-making. And I think that's really the first thing. The second thing, and slightly controversially, I'll say, I don't think behavioral science is really a science. I think we kind of kid ourselves if we think it's like physics with immutable laws. I think there's a lot of creativity, innovation, and the famous word evolution, which are as important in behavioral science as they are in magic. In fact, things move and change and we learn more. And, you know, physics is guided by laws. But when I think when we're talking about behavioral science or indeed investment management, it's different. It's guided by people's behaviors. And the same thing applies to magic. And I guess the third thing I'd say is it's all about the secrets, because the difference is when we're trying to uncover secrets of the mind in the behavioral science world, I know, I'm loving the research. I'm loving the fact that experiments get done. I'm loving the fact, actually, when experiments can't be replicated. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is important, because people say, oh, behavioral science is rubbish, they can't replicate. Well, no, not everything replicates, and why should it? And often there's good reasons why it doesn't replicate, and often it doesn't replicate. So we move on. We have to evolve. And I think that's a pretty healthy attitude. And there's a magician called Michael Weber who has a nice comment about magic. He says, magicians do not keep secrets from their audiences. They keep secrets for their audiences. Mm. I've always liked that. So there's my link.
So I love your quote earlier about coming to the wrong conclusion for the right reason. And it's sort of colored my own thinking around what's rational and what's irrational. And I think I've almost stopped talking and thinking about it in those terms and have started thinking about more adaptive versus maladaptive. You know, our evolutionary wiring is what it is. We're going to come to the conclusions we come to. And sometimes it's going to serve you well and sometimes it won't. You know, I've written about things like emotion and investing. There's ways where emotion and investing serves us very poorly. And there's times when you can sort of align emotion with a goal. Like, right, we've seen that the goals-based investing literature and, you know, simple things like having people focus on a picture of their children before they make a financial decision causes them to save more and be thriftier. Like, that's not rational, but it's adaptive. And so you have a great TEDx talk that I would encourage everyone to go check out. It's really accessible. You show some of these visual illusions. Even your logo itself is sort of a visual illusion. But, you know, I wrote in The Behavioral Investor about how difficult it is to overcome some of the biases that beset us precisely because they serve us so well in other arenas in life. So could you talk, you mentioned the word evolution earlier. Can you talk about the evolutionary origins of behavioral bias and the implications for overcoming them, because this is sort of how we're wired?
Well, I think you've got it there in sort of one, in terms of things can be irrational, but in the wrong context, they appear irrational. Sorry, things can be rational, but they appear irrational in the wrong context. And I'm sure you've read all the works of people like Gerd Gigerenzo on this, who kind of take a bit of issue with the Kahneman approach, which is basically to say that you get it when you read Thinking Fast and Slow, you kind of end up with the conclusion that biases are generally bad things. Yes, I think that's what the layperson reading that book will generally come up with. And I think what Gigerenzo and others have tried to counter that with is to say, actually, they're there for perfectly good reasons. And you mentioned the word evolution. The evolutionary reasons determine a lot of the way our unconscious minds work. And I know you've got something, haven't you, in your work called the Irrationality Index, but that's all about greed and fear. Mm-hmm. And how much emotion can I measure, which I think is really interesting. So the reason I think that's particularly interesting is because what you've done there is take two emotions and say, right, these emotions exist. It is what it is. Put them in the context of a financial market, which is kind of an artificial environment. It's not like the sort of ancestral planes on the savannah our brains have been, you know, wired to for, well, choose your number, between 200,000 and 6 million years, I guess. It's a very modern artificial environment, the financial stock market, for example. So some of the things that drive our behaviors in the ancestral environment, which are hardwired in there deep down, however logical and rational and using our neocortex Homo sapiens brain we think we're using, we still occasionally default to those old brain emotions, if you like. So a good example I was thinking is something like in the stock market when you see a bubble. Now, what's causing a bubble? Well, people say, oh, it's all these irrational biases, it's the herd instinct, it's the bandwagon effect. And yes, it does look very irrational just to buy something because something's already gone up and lots of other people are buying it, and my neighbor's buying it, and my sister's cousin's milkman's buying it, and so I must buy it as well. And that does happen from time to time in markets or cryptocurrencies or whatever you want to talk about. It happens occasionally in most asset classes. And it does look irrational, particularly in hindsight, when you see that big bubble and then normally there's a big crash afterwards. But think about what's actually going on there. And yes, we can talk about greed and fear, but what's going on there is people are seeing other people doing something successfully. They're making money. They're enthusiastic. They're optimistic about it. I don't want to miss out. So I join that bandwagon. Now, in a sort of security evolution, that makes sense. If other people are doing something successful and I copy what they're doing, that's an incredibly good way of getting my DNA down to the next generation when we're talking about some sort of ancestral environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, herds of wildebeest or flocks of starlings, you've seen them all. You know, they're there for survival and protection reasons. But when you get the same thing in a stock market, you get a bubble and then you get a bust. So it's the wrong context, essentially. It's the wrong environment. But the actual reason to do it isn't as irrational as it may seem.
Yeah, that's a great example. And, you know, I think about soldiers with post-traumatic stress and things like this. You know, there was a time in your life when you heard a loud noise, the thing for you to do was to sort of duck and cover. Now, when you get back to, you know, when you get back to whatever, Ohio, and you hear a car backfire and you duck and cover, that's maladaptive, right? Like that behavior made sense for a certain time and place, and it doesn't here. Like there's many, many places where following the herd serves us quite well. And I mean, look, I talk in some of my books about when I travel a great deal, and I rely very heavily on restaurant apps, Yelp, and you know all these restaurant rating apps. And I've never been led astray by a restaurant with a 4.5 or better. It's universally good because other people say so. But if you can misapply that logic, that herd understanding to markets, and then you get in trouble. So I think it's less about behaviors being objectively rational or irrational. And like you've said, does the behavior fit the context?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good example, that PSDD example. Just back to the stock markets, I mean, there are so many. I started in the stock market in 1986. I worked with Schroders for 17 years. And so I saw the 87 crash. But the biggest memory from the era for me was the, let's call it the tech boom that led to a stock market bubble in the 97, 98, 99 era.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it actually peaked in the UK at the end of the year, about a month later in the US. Now, that to me was extraordinary because we're sitting there at our desks, we're trying to manage money on fundamental, sound, decent methodologies, and everything is going up. Everything that's remotely tech-related is going up. And you know, and you're sitting there in front of clients, maybe quarter after quarter, underperforming the index because you haven't bought these tech stocks that have got no profits, no revenue, nothing. They're just all built on a dream, but someone's buying them, or rather lots of people are buying them. And you have to decide, are you going to capitulate or not? Because at some point you may well do that. Lots of people did, and unfortunately they did near the top. My favorite story from that era was a company called Norris Communications. I don't know if you know it or know of it. It was a tech company in the US. It was quite small. And it did kind of audio digital recording equipment. So it was definitely a tech company. But for some reason, its share price didn't go up in 97, 98, 99 in the same way that all the other tech stocks are going up. And the story goes, and I haven't actually verified every detail of this, but I think the principle is absolutely right. They got together and they said, look, we're not going to change our product, our distribution, our management. We're going to change one thing, our name. And they changed from Norris Communications to E-Digital, because digital, E and E's were really good in those days, if you remember.
Yeah.
Really cool was E. And so, and literally by changing their name, and you can go back and look at the share price, it went from 6 cents to 16 cents to 60 cents to $6 to $16 and peaked at $24.50. Nothing changed apart from the name change, and people were talking about it on the bulletin boards. Nothing else changed. And so that really is the herd instinct, the bandwagon effect, being, you know, a pretty unhelpful way of making good long-term investments. And needless to say, it doesn't exist these days, that company. But it's a good example of quite how crazy people can get during a bubble. And I, you know, I'm a historian from my university days, my college days. And so I always love looking at these old stock market booms and busts and seeing what people were saying and doing and seeing what the ingredients were to make a bubble, because they don't happen very often in the main stock market. They'll happen in sectors occasionally. And it's fascinating. And it does come back to something you highlighted earlier, sort of greed and fear.
Yeah. So the names change, but the story remains the same. There was, I think, a a tea company who made, you know, tea in New York, outside of New York. And during the blockchain, in I think 2017-ish, during sort of the height of the blockchain craze, they changed their name from, you know, whatever, you know, Long Island Iced Tea to Long Island Blockchain, and said they were going to start mining crypto. And it just went absolutely crazy. You know, this tea company that's 50 years old says they're going to buy a couple of computers now and mine Bitcoin, and it just goes completely nuts. So Paul, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, you've done a number of podcasts. I tried to find some questions that you hadn't been asked before. And one of the ones that I was interested in, because I know you're a big time student of the game, in your years of study of the field, what's one finding from the behavioral science, behavioral finance literature that you find both personally fascinating and sort of under-discussed? So what's sort of a deep cut that doesn't get the recognition that it should?
Well, I think there's more awareness now of some of the big mistakes that investors make. I say there's more awareness, whether people are actually acting upon it or not, I don't know. So, for example, oh, just one little aside before I get onto the financial side, it's quite interesting. Because of the behavioral science is so broad, one thing I work with doctors, I work with barristers, and I obviously work with lots of people in the investment industry. And one little thing I found, Daniel, is that actually, if you're talking to a bunch of financial people, they love the anecdotes that come from the legal and the medical world. But talk to a bunch of doctors and lawyers, they want to hear the mistakes that the financiers have made. There's a huge amount of cross-fertilization with this wonderful subject. And again, that's why I hesitate to use the word science, sort of in the physics sense of the word. And there's a lot of kind of cross-cultural learnings. So one of the things that I've found a lot of is what biases or mental shortcuts, a term I prefer to use, apply both to a doctor and to an investor or things like that. So, for example, let's just think now. There's a wonderful story that happened in New York, in Roosevelt Hospital, back at the turn of the 20th century. And there was a doctor there who was considered to be a genius, a guru at identifying smallpox. And people would bring patients or people they thought might have smallpox to him, and he would get it right, the diagnosis, every time. And the strange thing was, it took them a few months to realize. And what would happen, they'd come in, they'd say, this is so-and-so, and the doctor would examine them. And the way he would examine them, actually, he would get them to stick their tongue out, and he'd look at their tongue very closely and kind of handle it. And a few months later, they realized his diagnosis for smallpox was near perfect. But then they realized why. Because he was infecting with smallpox. Because he was a carrier. And so his forecast, he was unknowingly giving them, I should say. He wasn't doing it nefariously. And this man had been a guru for a few months and then was a pariah. Now, interestingly, go back to the investment world. Think about someone that gets 3 or 4 years of performance right, that outperformed quite a long way. They've suddenly got kind of guru status. And you know, their assets and their management grow. And by the way, they may be getting it right for absolutely the right reasons. And I emphasize that. Mm-hmm. But there will be a few people who've got outperformed for 3 years in a row, and they've risen to the top of the league tables. Mm-hmm. Got there by possibly luck. And again, this great debate about skill versus luck, and the Michael Mabuson talks about the skill luck continuum. And I look back on sort of my three decades in the investment management industry, and I know that I have worked with some pretty good fund managers, and I really have done, who've got a really good philosophy, a really good process. They stick to it. They'll be flexible and adaptive if required, but I also know that out there in the industry, there will have been lots of fund managers, and we don't need to name any names, who've had a meteoric rise, gathered in so many assets, and then guess what? It's all gone crashing down. So there's a sort of parallel there between a medical example and a financial example. So what's the human mental shortcut going on there? Overconfidence. The idea being that the person doing the managing of the money just feels that he or she has got the ability to walk on investment water, if you like. There's a kind of halo effect there, that the people who want to invest in him or her think they can do nothing wrong. So they'll also listen to their views on politics or religion or anything else, thinking, they get it right in one area, they get, therefore they must be perfect in all other areas. And you see so many examples of this. So again, this is why I love this stuff, because, you know, I can talk to doctors about this, or about financial examples, or financial people about medical examples. It all ends up in the same place. Yeah. Your mind plays tricks. Bang.
Well, that's an incredible story. And, you know, your point about the doctors and the lawyers and the attorneys and the financiers is so interesting, because one of my soapboxes is, you know, look, people listen to one of your talks, they read my books, and I think the first impulse is to say, oh, my neighbor's like that, my wife's like that, my kid's like that, my clients are like that. And really, the first thing we need to do is turn it back on ourselves and sort of examine the ways that we are like that and how we are susceptible to that. Everybody loves these quirky anecdotes to go, hey, wow, look how dumb other people are. And I think one of the tricky things about studying behavioral science is the first law of behavioral science is you're just as fallible as the next person. And until you can sort of own that and adopt that opinion, you're going to struggle.
Can I tell you a dumb anecdote about myself?
Yeah.
There were three of us. We went to run in the Paris Half Marathon a few years ago. Two of them were very senior executives, very senior, in the advertising and marketing worlds. And there was me from the financial world. And you go run the Paris Half Marathon, you have to go and collect your running number and stuff the day before. And you have to go out to a park that's way outside Paris. You have to get the metro to get there. And the three of us went down the day before to get our running kit. And when we got to the metro station in Paris, all the machines were full, were big queues. And a man came up to us in a uniform wearing a hat and said, can I help you, gentlemen? And he realized we were lost. And we said, yeah, we're trying to buy some tickets because we're trying to go out to the park. He said, oh, I can help you, come this way. And he took me around to a different machine that was on its own. And he said, put your credit card in there. He said, I'll take the credit card, put it in there, didn't work, gave it back to us. And then he said, I'll use mine, and you can pay me the cash. And he got out three tickets. And we said, how much is that? And he said, 48 euros each. And we gave him 50 each. We gave him a tip of 2 euros on top of the 48. He gave us the three tickets. And he said, have a great run. Good luck, guys. And Allez les Bleus, we were talking about football and everything. He was a really chatty guy wearing this smart uniform. And then we went out to the park and we got our numbers and stuff. And then we had to come back. And when we tried to get into the metro station by the park, the ticket wouldn't let us in through the gate. And we took it to the office and said, look, we don't understand. We just bought a weekend's ticket. And the person looked at us and said, started laughing and said, this is a child's one-way ticket. And the guy scammed us totally. He totally scammed us. And the two other guys I was with were furious. And I genuinely realized that I was as foolish as anybody else. I'd fallen for the great authority trick. The guy had done two things. He was wearing a hat, a nice peaked hat, mm-hmm. and he was helpful, right? Mm-hmm. And being human, I responded to the authority, the authority stimulus, and someone was trying to help me in my hour of need. And I started laughing, and they said, why do you find it funny? We just wasted 50 euros each. And I said, guys, this is a great lesson. It reminds me that when I talk about these kind of influences and persuasion techniques and everything else, I'm as vulnerable as anybody else because I was completely convinced this guy was genuine, completely convinced. And I have to say that many, many years later, they're laughing about it now. We still laugh about it. And it's a true story. That reminds me that I've got as many mental shortcuts as anybody else.
So I love that story. I love your, you know, your learning from it. But Paul, doesn't it, it's that story to me is sort of a perfect example of how we can't be on guard against behavioral bias at all times. Because I mean, what if you were to try and sort of perfectly anticipate and protect against these things, you would move through the world in sort of just such a skeptical, nihilistic way. Like if someone's trying to help you buy a ticket and they, you know, it looks like a, you know, looks like a duck and it walks like a duck. Like, I mean, I think that's the thing is sometimes we're going to get fooled, but.
But Daniel, you're right. But something as simple as saying, asking myself, where could I be wrong here? Or I could have said, could I see some ID? Or just ask a question. But it was too good to be true. And we know about the old adage, if it's too good to be true, it isn't. So what that's taught me is you can guard against these things. Because, again, me telling the story now, people listening will think, what an idiot. But I swear to you, I was completely taken at the time. And also, by the way, when we listened to that story, knew there was going to be an unhappy ending because I said it was a dumb story about myself. it does happen. But I think, and again, this would apply to investment. Let's not get off the subject too much. You know, asking this question, it's a simple question, where could I be wrong, is a really good thing that many of us don't do enough about the big decisions. You can't do this about small decisions because otherwise you'd never get to anything in your life. But a big decision, where could I be wrong? And, you know, someone once said to me, in fact, I'll tell you who actually did it rather than said it to me. Charles Darwin used to do it. He used to take a piece of paper, put a line down the middle and say reasons for, reasons against, and just try and list them. And part of that experiment is to put down some crazies on there, some crazy reasons, just to try and throw out some ideas. And again, you can't do that often, but for big decisions, it's not a bad thing to do, just to try and see what the other side would say. Now, back to my Metro example, where could I be wrong? Should I just check he's genuine? All he's got on is a smart, sort of smartish student jacket on, but he's wearing a hat. It was the peak cap. It was the cap that made it.
Yeah.
Now, listen, so it's it was a wonderful lesson, I have to say. It cost me 50 euros, but it was a wonderful lesson.
Hey, 50 euros for a good lesson's not a bad deal. So you mentioned Rory Sutherland earlier. I meant to say at the time, his book Alchemy, I forget which year it came out, a few years ago. It was absolutely the best book I read that year. It's just a really, really incredible book for anyone who hasn't read it. But, you know, one thing that I love about people like you, people like Rory, is that you take your knowledge of behavioral science and apply it very broadly and not just to investing. And part of your consulting work is around improving sales. So this isn't, I don't think, anything we've ever discussed on the podcast before. Where can behavioral science help us improve our ability to sell? Because this is something we all have to do, whether we like it or not.
The sale, I mean, I should say actually that I had a 30-year career in the city, of which about half was actually as a portfolio manager and half was as head of distribution or sales or whatever you want to call it, business development at Schroders and at PIMCO and finally at Goldman Sachs Asset Management. And so for me, one of the joys of learning about behavioral science is actually not just understanding how your mind plays tricks or where we make mental shortcuts. It's about how do I use the way the mind does and doesn't work to be a better communicator, to be more persuasive, to be more, and I emphasize in an ethical sense, and this is something that Bob Cialdini does in his book Influence. He talks about ethical persuasion. I'm not talking about mind control or that kind of nonsense. I'm talking about how do I become a better arguer, a better debater, using psychological tips and tricks. And that's really the basis of my sales workshops. Is I'm not going to teach you basic presentation skills, because guess what? Anybody can do that. There are thousands of people out there that do that. But if I can teach you ways to be more, to connect better with a client using some of these psychological principles in an ethical, decent way, which makes you a better salesperson, then I surely will. And I think the first thing you need to do is to, as a salesperson, often try and reframe the situation to become more persuasive. And funny enough, I've just received a book from a guy called Roger Martin. You probably know him. And he's really good. He says, if you can define the problem differently than anybody else in the industry, you can generate alternatives that others aren't thinking about. And so I'm always trying to sort of redefine an issue, a challenge, a problem. So when we talk about salespeople, the first thing I try and do is redefine the way that they've been taught how to sell. And I think the way that certainly in the financial industry that we tend to default to, and again, this is your system two, this is your rider on top of the elephant. We like to default to the logical, analytical, evidence-based, rational way of persuasion. So we think that if we give somebody lots of facts and figures and data, then we're most of the way home towards persuading them to buy our product, for example. And by the way, I'm not knocking that approach whatsoever. I'm saying don't just do that. And too many people start off a presentation, they'll open their book and they'll say, you know, they'll show a map of the world with their 37 offices around the world and the 120 analysts, and you know, they'll be playing that sort of game. And that's, again, it's all good, it's necessary. But I put to you, that's not going to connect you with the people you want to connect with. It may help connect you, but there are things you can do on top of that are way better. And for me, my source of interest, I'll go back to who I think is the first behavioral scientist, right? And people say, who was it, you know, 20th century? I say, no, Aristotle. Mm. Aristotle is for me the first behavioral scientist, because his book on rhetoric is absolutely superb. The book is about how to persuade people to do things. And long before there was Bob Cialdini, there was Aristotle. And Aristotle had this idea that there were three sort of ways you could persuade somebody. There was logos, logic. And that's the way that I think the asset management industry works on its assumptions. You know, I will persuade you through logic, through facts, through figures, through data, through evidence. And I give that a huge tick, right? But Aristotle said, also, you can use ethos. What does ethos mean? It means the credibility of who you or your organization are. So again, there's your maps of the world. There's your number of research analysts. There's your where your share price has grown or something. That's good. I give that a big tick. What I think we in the investment industry can learn from is the third leg of Aristotle's tricolon of suggestions, which is pathos. And what does that mean? Well, pathos doesn't just mean being fluffy and nice and aren't we all lovely together. Pathos is about actually putting myself in the client's shoes. So, for example, and thinking, well, what does the client want? Because I know when I go into a presentation, I want to win their business. That's not what the client said. The client's there to solve their problem. So I need to immediately redefine the challenge. It's not winning the business, but solving the client's problem. And if I can do that, I'm taking to a slightly different dimension to most people that are sticking to the logos and ethos argument. So how do we do that in real life? Well, I think the first thing we say, right, well, let me give you a metaphor. When I 2 days ago, in our sort of midlife crisis that I'm in, which I'm not really, I went and bought myself a new car. And the guy knew why I liked the car. I liked it because it was a convertible, small, open-top sports car. And I, you know, I'm pretty enthusiastic. I was talking about what I was the first car I ever had in the 1990s, and I wanted a modern version of an MX-5. And he knew me. He knew me. He made me sit in it. He made me almost smell it. He made me have a test drive in it. The noise was fantastic and everything. And he knew that I was going to buy this red MX-5. And I'm smiling there thinking, I haven't held anything back here at all. And we got out of the car and I said to him, I suppose I better look at the engine. Now, I don't know the first thing about bloody cars, right? And I needed. So we opened the engine and I said, I looked around and said, you know, I don't understand what's going on here. It looks pretty good. we shut the hood and off I go and I paid for the car. Now, that's a slightly flippant metaphor, but I want to make a serious point about business and presentations. I think too many fund managers spend too much time talking about how every spark plug and valve and lead in the engine works without reminding themselves that the client wants to sit in that car and feel safe and feel comfortable. And maybe they want speed. Maybe they want an aggressive equity portfolio or something. I'm not trying to say determine the sorts of assets. I'm just saying that there are things there that are not simply put down to, oh, we manage the money really well because we've they want to feel something that's not just about a spreadsheet. And you know, as someone once said, not everything that be counted counts, not everything that counts can be counted. And so this whole idea of adding pathos to a presentation is really interesting. So one thing I do in my workshops, and this is pure behavioral science here, is something called FAB analysis, F-A-B. And I get the client to go through their presentation deck, their booklet, and I give them three highlighters. I give them a red highlighter, an orange highlighter, and a green highlighter. And I say, right, there are three different sorts of statements in your presentation book. There are features. That's the F of FAB, right? Go through your booklet, and everything that's a feature, put a red highlight through, right? Then there are advantages. So a feature might be, we have 37 offices around the world. That's a feature, right? Then you might have the A of advantages. So when you specify that something gives you a sort of added edge, we're going to give that an orange light. So go through that. And so you might say, if you put, we have 37 offices around the world, which gives us access to global industries, meaning we can cover them 24/7. That would probably get an orange one, because you've actually listed an advantage over some of your competitors, as opposed to just the feature. But the most interesting one is the B. B stands for benefits to the client. And when people go through their books, guess what? 60% is red, it's features. 20 or 30% is orange. If you're lucky, 10% will actually talk about the client or talk about the benefit to the client of doing it this way. Now, I put to you that if you want to connect with the client a bit better, you need a bit more green in there. You need a few more benefits to the client. And this, now, here's the problem. Someone said to me, "Oh, right, I'll just do the whole booklet full of benefits." No, you can't do that, because that comes across as really cheesy and fluffy. You've got to sprinkle benefits throughout through the booklet, no more than, you know, one a page maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the example. Let me give you an example. So the fact we have all these offices around the world with all these analysts managing 24/7 means that our clients can sleep well at night. I mean, I'm slightly fluffy phrase there. But if you can get the impression across to a client, you're going to sleep well at night because of all these wonderful offices we have. It's way better than just sitting there like a stuffed robot saying, you know, we've got offices. So you're reframing the basic sentence to say, it's not about me anymore, it's about you.
Mm-hmm.
And you start to connect. And this is the pathos. This is the pathos of Aristotle. It's not just relying on logos and ethos. I'll give you another example. I don't give too much away, because I run workshops, but I'm in the mood now. In these days of electronics and laptops and iPads and everything, there's something you can do if you're making a presentation or a pitch that is extraordinarily powerful. It's not a guarantee of success, but let's put it this way. If it's 50-50 against someone else, this is the kind of thing that will tip you as 52-48. You're sitting around the table with a bunch of people, and you only do this once during a presentation, by the way. You make a point of making sure there's an old-fashioned whiteboard in the room, or a chart, you know, a white chart, paper thing with felt tips. And you make a point at some sort of standing up from the presentation, say, perhaps I can just illustrate that. And you draw something quick, hopefully reasonably clear to see, nothing complicated. It could be something as simple as a yield curve. So as you can see, the short end rates are 1.5%, and the curve goes up to 4%, then drops down to 2%, or whatever it may be. You're just making a point using a visual, using an old-fashioned whiteboard. And what all the work that I've ever done on it, and I've used this technique many times, is you're very powerful, because what you've done there is a handful of things to change the whole relationship between you and your audience. So what have you done? First of all, you've changed the dynamic of the room, because everyone's sitting down, heads down, shoulders stooped. I've now stood up, and I'm now addressing them from a slightly higher vantage point. It means they all look up, right? Mm. No longer can they look down their books or, dare I say, fiddle with their phone under the table, right? They have got to pay attention now, because you've suddenly stood up, right? Second, you've drawn something that's helpful, okay? You've illustrated a point. Even if you could describe it in words, you've used a simple diagram as a picture. Thirdly, and this I think is the genius, this I think is playing to the unconscious mind, okay? You've slightly changed your relationship. You're no longer a presenter to a potential client. You're a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Last time they sat around and looked at someone do something on the board was at school, right? So unconsciously, you've added a new role to your position. I'm trying to help you learn something by doing this. Now, I want to emphasize, you know, this is no guarantee of success, but it's something you can do, and you can do it ethically and meaningfully and with good intent to make your point stronger. But you've helped change the dynamic in a way that I think then suddenly gives you a big advantage over someone that just sits down behind the desk and stays shoulders stooped, looking down at the booklets. You've done something different. And again, I've changed the name of the room. So again, listen, I'm not going to ever pretend that that alone will win you the business. It won't, because you've got to have all the facts, the figures, the data, the ethos, mm-hmm. and the logos. I'm just saying, add a bit of pathos, or add some psychological different perspectives on it, and suddenly you become a much more powerful presenter. And so this is the kind of stuff I love talking about. I've got about 20 of these different ideas. I've given a couple of them away today, but I think it's, I want to give you a sense that behavioral science for me is as useful in terms of sales and presentations as it is in terms of investment. And that's why I run sort of two modules, really, a content module and a delivery module about how to use this stuff. But I mean, my first love is still investment, I should say that. And I think that's sort of where I think behavioral science really does interest me. And of course, I got into it because people said, well, look, Paul, you've become quite well known on the behavioral science thing when I was working with PIMCO and then later Goldman. You're getting lots of meetings with clients and things, which is great. They love this stuff. But the firms weren't unreasonable in asking this simple question: how do you monetize it? And lots of theories out there. You've written about it. Richard Thaler, others have written about it. Some people say you need to take a sort of deep value approach, the sort of Warren Buffett type way, or others say a quant approach is the best way. And I've never quite come down firmly on either of those two. I like both of them for those sorts of logical reasons that it makes sense. You're trying to take human decision-making out of it in terms of quant, and in terms of deep value, you're trying to buy stuff everyone hates. I like that idea as well. But for me, the real value of behavioral science for investors is not about a product, not about this is a fund that is a behavioral science fund. It's about essentially changing the behavior of individual fund managers. And I kind of like to think of it as behavioral science offering opportunities not just to understand their own behaviors, but to identify, analyze, and then rule out their misbehaviors. And that for me is where I think the sort of the edge that behavioral science gives. Anybody who's into behavioral science has an edge over that someone who doesn't. So I've waited 30 years to find a company that does this. And I'm delighted to say I have found one. You should look it up. There's a company called Behavior Lab, www.behaviorlab, which is a kind of startup fintech company that are doing just this kind of stuff. So they're not just analyzing trades and how long stocks are held for. There are others that do that as well, but they do it very, very well. But they then try and integrate it into the process of a fund manager. And they've had tremendous results. They look after about 190 billion at the moment. So they've got sort of quite a few years track record. And so, for example, they'd work with, if a fund manager holds a stock too long, they will work with them and they'll work in with their process. Why do you do that? And it's very interesting indeed. And the fact that they've, I think, managed to add to annual performance by something like 1.5 to 2% a year, which is really just cutting out the bad biases, the bad stuff. If you cut out the bad stuff, your performance goes up massively. But I think the thing that excites me most of all about them is the fact that all of their clients who came to them with an initial project have come back for a lot more. So, and that goes on to a point I have got a bit of a bee in my bonnet about, is about why I think relationships matter more than transactions. I'm really, really strong about this because having worked in the industry for as long as I have done, I'm very aware that, we don't have a good reputation in the media or with the public. Why? Because there's scandals occasionally, there's stock market booms and busts that don't always play well in the media, particularly the busts. And I think that too many people think of investment, long-term investment included, as being sort of people shouting and screaming down phones, buy, sell, buy, sell, buy, sell. Well, and I know that actually the vast majority of investment management long-term is for good, sensible, decent, moral reasons. It's to pay pensions, insurance policies, to help mum and dad retire. And that the motivation for the industry is good, and most people's hearts are very good behind who are in it as well. Unfortunately, the bad guys get the name. And so hence my emphasis on relationships, matter more transactions. It's more important for me to lose this bit of business today, but build up a good relationship with you over the long term than it is to, and I'm lucky because I mean, asset managers should be thinking that anyway. Investment banks, maybe a bit more transactional in business, but certainly asset management businesses, I've worked in all three of them. You try and have a client for 20, 30 years, ideally, in whatever game you're in. And that I feel is the most important thing that we as an industry could do to change our image is emphasize that relationships matter more than single transactions.
Yeah, there's so much I love about what you just said. You know, part of what interests me so much about behavioral science is how broadly it can be applied. You know, you've given the example here of how it can be applied to help fund managers make better decisions. You gave some really great examples of how we can appeal more to the elephant, perhaps, than the rider when making sales presentations, and how that can be powerful. You know, Paul, there's this Steve Jobs talk when he was rejoining the company, and he's sort of speaking after rejoining Apple after being fired, and they're talking about their Think Different campaign. And he uses the example of Apple and also of Nike. And, you know, he talks about Nike doesn't say, look, our air soles, you know, our shoes are more cushiony than your shoes. They appeal to great athletes and great athletics, right? They honor great athletes and great athletics. That's the elephant. Everyone else is over here trying to compare the width of your air soles. That's a loser's, right? Like, that's a loser's game. And yet we spend so much time trying to appeal in our persuasive processes to the rider. And we could spend a lot more time letting that person smell the leather in the car, rev the engine, and less time with them with a brochure that talks about the horsepower, right?
We should be careful here, though. I mean, there will be petrol heads. There will be people that love the engines. And so we're not saying don't buy that. We're just saying don't think that's all you need to apply to most people who want to hear the engine rev and smell the leather, because there are lots of people like that. And we kid ourselves if we think that we can sell a car just through how clever the engine is.
Now, I want to, Paul, I want to pick up this conversation about transactions versus relationships. I mean, I'm in complete agreement with you, but does behavioral science have something to tell us about how to have less transactional, deeper relationships with our clients and the people we serve? Can we learn anything from behavioral economics about how to connect with one another?
Absolutely. And I think the key thing is this idea of reciprocity in the sense of, I mean, here we go again, the going back to sort of ancient evolutionary ideals, if you like, or certainly ideas. Humans have done pretty well. There have been moments of where it hasn't gone well, but over the years, and largely progress has come through collaboration and cooperation, not through killing each other. Now, we've killed each other plenty of times in history. I'm not going to say we don't. But the big changes in society, whether it be the move to sort of from hunter-gatherer to, which was, you know, successful in its own way for many years, hundreds of thousands of years, to an agricultural, to an industrial society, to a technological society, a lot of that is based upon cooperation and collaboration. And so when I think about something, you know, where's the sort of behavioral science aspect perspective on this one? I think about reciprocity ultimately as being a force for good. So, for example, you know, if you do something nice for me, I will do something nice for you. It's just very, very hard as a human being, unless you're a psychopath, not to respond in kind to kindness. And as my uncle Richard used to say, it's nice to be nice. It really does pay dividends. It doesn't always work. And we know about some of the game theory about this, where they've played various games, you know, but actually, in my experience, and I think the experience of history, is that actually people who are interested in being cooperative and collaborative tend to build on things to get things better in the long term. And I think this comes back to this idea of, again, liking somebody. If people like you, they'll talk to you. If they trust you, they'll give their money to look after for 20, 30 years. So I'd like to think that, now, you don't have to like someone to trust them, but it kind of helps in a way. It's a nice building block. So I've always thought of that. So whenever I've tried to deal with partnerships, or when I try and deal with my sales workshops, the one thing I emphasize is, and it was something taught to me by a guy called Bob Mobley, who died this year, earlier this year. Bob was a mentor of mine back in the 90s, and Bob taught me many, many things. But one thing that's just stuck in my head, and he wouldn't have called this behavioral science, but I think it is. He said, three rules of partnership. What can I do for you? What can you do for me? And what can we do for each other? Now, if you go through those three things in any meeting, so you go to a meeting with a client or a prospect or whatever, and you kind of have those things written down as three bullet points on your notepad, what can you do for me? What can I do? What can you do for each other? And you start to frame the conversation, particularly in terms of what I can do for you and what we can do for each other, you're suddenly not talking about a business transaction. You're talking about a partnership. And I think, again, this plays upon what Cialdini calls liking, what we call reciprocity. I mean, we're playing the same game here. We're appealing to the better nature of the elephant. So what elephants generally respond pretty well. And so this is why, you know, this is why for me, the whole thing needs to be done ethically. And again, I want to reemphasize, it's not about mind control. I'm not trying to get people to do things they don't want to do. I want them to want to do it for the right reasons, because together we're going to be stronger than just each of us on our own. And if that's a business relationship through a portfolio management structure, or whether we be, you know, working in the street together, building, digging a hole, it doesn't matter. There are ways you can build bridges all the time. And so it's always goes for me, it's about building bridges opposed to walls. And I think behavioral science helps us build bridges because we understand how the human mind works better. And again, I'm sorry to go back to magic, but very briefly, you know, there are some magicians that like to sort of, you know, they're very few, by the way, because guess what? They're not successful, who don't have a rapport with their audience. The best ones do. And here's the thing. If you really enjoy a show, let's call it a magic show, ultimately, you don't remember what you saw. You remember how you felt at the time. That's what you remember when you go away. I really enjoyed that evening. It was a great evening. Okay. Now, I'm not saying you can do the same with every business meeting, but you can certainly remember that it's not just about giving them the data, the facts, the figures. Those are important. But if you can let someone leave the meeting, say, feeling smarter when they walked in because you've taught them something, that's a bloody helpful thing to do, because there's a bit of reciprocity there. They then owe you something. And again, it's not they owe you, they must pay. It's because they want to do it because they're nice people and you're nice people. So I know this sounds a bit apple pie and, you know, motherhood, but I really believe this stuff. I really believe there's room for integrity and value and values and these kind of things, as much as there is about cutthroat transactional. In fact, there's a lot more than those about than cutthroat transactional nature of business. So, I mean, capitalism thrives, I think, when it's done well, and it gets a terribly bad name when it's done terribly. So we need to make sure we, you know, sharpen our act up and start behaving well, because otherwise, Main Street, you know, will react, and why shouldn't they?
Well, it may sound apple pie, but it's backed by the research. And, you know, the thing that I love about the reciprocity research is it's not all about buying someone a steak dinner, even though that is nice. You know, it's things like adding value to their lives, right? It's like, can you add value to their lives through educating them? Can you compliment them? Can you make an introduction? Can you make life easier? There's so many ways to add value to someone's life that have nothing to do with even spending a dollar necessarily. So I think that's important to remember. So Paul, we're getting short on time. I'm going to give you a couple of lightning round questions. I'm just going to ask you a quick question. I need a quick response. First thing that comes to your head, stream of consciousness. Are you ready?
Okay.
Greatest modern magician.
Oh, that's impossible. my favorite magicians, rather than greatest. There's a gentle. I'll give two US magicians, Joshua Jay, who's written a book, by the way, I'd recommend that all investors read. All presenters and salespeople read. It's called How Magicians Think. It's written for the layperson. It's full of behavioral insights. Joshua Jay. He's a creator, obviously an author. He's a brilliant magician. He's full Penn and Teller. It's a great book for anybody interested in how to interact with people and the advances of the form of magic. Probably my number one magician in the world is a guy called Jeff McBride. Jeff opened up the stage behind me in this room. That's now called the McBride stage. Jeff lives in Las Vegas. He just eats, drinks, sleeps, breathes magic. He's so infectious, and he offers training schools to magicians, even to non-magicians, actually. I went on a course many, many, many years ago called Magic for Public Speakers. Mm. And there were people there that were magicians who had never spoken in public before, and there are people who were public speakers who never done any magic before. Mm-hmm. This was one of many, many courses he gives, by the way, because he also helps the world's top magicians with their acts and everything else. Las Vegas superstar. He's been on TV a lot in the States. They even, I think they wrote an episode of Star Trek for him to appear in. But he gave me a lot of personal tuition. So he's definitely, and I must give a British name, otherwise I'll get in trouble, but I'll get in trouble for not mentioning more than one. Gary Jones, magician in the UK. Any UK body, listen to this. He's funny, he's smart, he's creative, he's interesting. He likes a pint. He's also helped me with my magic, as Jeff, top man. And you'll know the name Darren Brown. I think Darren is one of the great. Sorry, apologies for that long answer.
No, it's fine. Darren Brown's specials are absolutely mind-blowing. You've given us a great book recommendation, one that I had never heard of, so thank you for that. I always love one that's sort of out of left field. Second question is, what's a behavioral science book that needs more love than it's gotten? Which, again, sort of a deep cut question.
Okay, so I've got a library of must be 200 behavioral books. A book I reread recently, and I emphasize reread, which I think is underappreciated because I hadn't appreciated it the first time round. It was in 2016, and it was by an author who I've mentioned a number of times in this podcast earlier, but everyone knows Bob Cialdini's first book, which is called Influence, mm-hmm. which I think is the best book on sales ever written, by the way.
Agreed.
Or certainly one of them. It's right up there. But Bob wrote a second book called Persuasion, Persuasion. And I think in the sort of the glory of his first book, the second book has got a bit missed. Now, I know it probably sold thousands and thousands of copies, but I think it could have sold more because when I mention it to other behavioral geeks like me, they've all read Influence, but they haven't read Persuasion. And the message of, I can't possibly do it justice in 30 seconds, but I'll just say, his big point is, before you deliver a message to try and persuade someone to do something, try and design the moment. So as you create a context that makes your message much more powerful. And I think it's absolutely brilliant. And I'll just give you one example from the book, which is so good. And I use this again in a lot of my workshops. It's quite a short book. The book's full of just gold dust. It really is. He cites some research by Balkan and Anderson that if you approach somebody in a street with a clipboard and say, can you quickly help me with a survey? You'll only get a success rate of about, he says, 29%. Okay. So less than one in three will help you if someone approaches you with a survey. And you know, your listeners must think now, if someone approached me on the sidewalk, am I going to sort of try and go around them or nod or just keep my head down? Right. Most of us walk past. Only less than one in three say, I'll help. If, however, the person can ask you this question, excuse me, would you consider yourself a helpful person? Guess what? Most people stop and say, nod or say yes. And then you say, will you help me with a survey? That 29% goes up to 77%. In other words, more than three quarters of people will help you if you ask them first, do you consider yourself a helpful person? Now, just think how powerful this is, because this is his consistency commitment principle.
Yeah.
I've done something small. I can't now go against it and break it. I've now got to keep going. And by the way, most people do this happily and unconsciously. It's not like, oh, damn, I've just fallen for a trick. I've said I'm helpful. I am helpful. God damn it. I'm going to help you with this survey. Yeah. So just think you've done there. With one short sentence, do you consider yourself a helpful person? Seven words. I've taken 29% success rate. Up to 77%. This book, Persuasion, is all about that. And it's absolutely fantastic. So I'm rereading it. It's just brilliant. So that's my underappreciated book in behavioral science.
Well, he's fantastic. I think Influence could be the best behavioral science book ever written. It's one that I go back to again and again and again. I think it's underloved by especially sales professionals, but absolutely fantastic suggestion. Paul, you have been a wellspring of great stories and great anecdotes and good information. If people want to learn more about your courses, if they want to find out more about you and your work, where can we follow you and learn more?
LinkedIn, obviously. My website is paulcraven.com. I'd be most happy if people followed me on Twitter. Someone once said to me, I was woefully underfollowed on Twitter. I've got 4,999 followers at the moment. So I'm hoping that this podcast will get me past 5,000. And I've written 50,000 words of my book, which is coming out in the spring of next year, I hope. Fingers crossed.
That is fantastic news. So
perhaps you'll have me back on to talk about the book.
No, I will definitely have you back on to talk about the book. See you at the Magic Show in November. Thank you again for being an incredible guest.
Thank you. And last piece of advice, David Niven, the actor, the British actor, and I have this pinned on the back of my gym door, which is in the basement. And every morning I'm in the gym, I come up and the last thing I see is as I'm hot and sweaty and I open the door to get into the house again. David Niven's word of advice, keep the circus going inside you. Keep it going. Don't take anything too seriously. It will all work out in the end.
Ah, that's great. Keep the circus going, listeners. Thank you again, Paul. Incredible information.
Thank you very much indeed for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.